Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
The truck exploded. Nothing hit us, but I felt the wave go through my belly. And it was profoundly destabilizing and unnerving.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with David Shupman. David has been a journalist for 40 years and spent 20 of those years leading the BBC's coverage of climate change and other environmental issues. He broadcasted from the Arctic and the Amazon and most places in between. In this episode, we talk about how he accessed the industry and the defining moments that profoundly affected his career and decision-making before looking at some of the issues we now collectively face, and ultimately his decision to become an independent speaker, writer and consultant with a focus on climate action. Over to David Shupman.
So it's great to be doing this with you. My name's David Shukman, and for really most of my adult life, I've been a journalist. And for 38 years, I can't believe I'm saying that, I was a journalist for the BBC, BBC News. And I did a variety of jobs for the BBC, beginning as a trainee and then spending a couple of years in Northern Ireland in the 80s during the Troubles, which involved a very steep learning curve about staying safe in trouble, trying to find out the truth of a situation when things were difficult and dangerous. And then I moved to London, and I'd always had this hankering to be a BBC foreign correspondent. That seemed to me like the real bee's knees, with somewhere tropical, with a ceiling fan and duty-free whiskey and me writing dispatches on a typewriter. And I ended up being correspondent in Brussels with a muddy little garden and no ceiling fan. but you know, so after a long, long series of steps, I ended up really for the last 20 years reporting on the environment and science. And that got me into a whole new world, which I didn't know a lot about, but proved to be the most interesting thing I've just ever done. And that kept me busy till COP26 a year ago in Glasgow, after which I left the BBC. And I'm now a freelance, which I'm kind of loving because I can pick and choose and I can say yes or no. And what I'm trying to describe myself as now is a kind of climate advocate or climate consultant, and to be a kind of nudger, to be a person who kind of tries to keep across the science and can explain it to people who are interested but don't get it, or to point out where people think they're doing the right thing but they're not. And my real sort of challenge right now is to be as tough as possible on greenwashing. So I see myself as a kind of greenwashing troubleshooter and try to point out when people are basically bullshitting about what they're doing and need to understand what the effect of their actions is or their inaction. So I've morphed from sort of, I'm still doing some journalism and a bit of telly, which I love, but the main focus is trying to find ways of what an Indian filmmaker friend calls narrow casting, rather than broadcasting to audiences of millions, which has its own attractions and rewards and satisfaction and what I've done for donkey's years, but to narrow casting where you really try to persuade key decision makers to shift. And the satisfaction there is when you see the penny drop. It's a very long way of describing what I'm doing now and where I've come from.
No, it's fascinating. And I think, you know, logically, we'll just step backwards because inevitably I want to get into the stuff you're doing now and what it is that motivates you and what the threats are. But I think it would be really interesting to talk about those early years and what it was that led you to crave that ceiling fan on the tropical island somewhere. What was the inspiration and motivation?
So I come from a family where international travel was kind of not normal, but fairly widely achieved. I had a fantastic aunt who actually has just died at the age of 96, who married a Dutch guy and they ran a little antique shop in Amsterdam. And then they got fed up and bored. And in the 60s, sold up, bought a Citroën De Chavaux bread van, which is a kind of vehicle that doesn't exist anymore, probably. And they chucked a Dunlopillo mattress in the back and a couple of cooking pots. And they drove all over the world in the 60s. They crossed the Sahara three times. They drove the length of the Americas. They crisscrossed continents. When they got bored of one continent, they found a ship and the crane would hoist the car onto the ship and they'd cross an ocean. When they got stuck on a muddy track in the Amazon rainforest, the car was light enough just to pick up and move. And they had adventures of a kind that really aren't kind of possible now. I mean, everything's got harder in terms of borders and regulations. And these two would do these fantastic journeys and then come and visit and show us pictures. And I was spellbound by that. And it just made me realize that there's a world out there that needs to be explored. And I wanted to do that. And my parents, as academics, specializing in Russia. My father's parents came from Russia. So there was a lot of conversation about family origins and Russia and Russian and so forth, that it was kind of not a huge leap, really, for me to think, well, I want a slice of travel to really interesting places. I mean, my father's father was a conscript in the Russian army in 1905 and was one of the first people sent to cross Russia on the Trans-Siberian Railway in a cattle truck to fight the Japanese. You know, so when you're brought up on stories like that, you think, well, I don't want the cattle truck, but I wouldn't mind Siberia, you know? And so, yes, I'd always had a hankering. And then at school, I had trouble concentrating. I wasn't a very kind of contented or successful sort of teenager. I was restless and did badly in A-levels. And the only A-level I got an A in was geography. And so everyone said, well, you better go to university and read geography, which I did at Durham. And there, the tutors I found most influential were often on expeditions abroad. They were going to the deserts of Oman. They were finding interesting things to study about favelas in South America. You know, there was a real sense of international academic inquiry. And I found that really interesting. And when huge events happened in the world, these guys, these tutors, my geography teachers, kind of had connections often and sort of could really explain what was happening. And so that kind of led me to journalism because I thought, well, one way to see the world, I mean, if you're really rich, you can pay for your own travel. If you're not rich, you need someone either to pay you to travel or better still pay you to do a job that involved travel. So that kind of led to, how do I become a foreign correspondent? And that led to the ceiling fan kind of image.
And so, I mean, and I'll leave you to tell the story, but it must have been an anticlimax to just be sent off to Northern Ireland in the middle of a war in that case, no?
Well, I mean, there was a mixed bag, really, because my first job was on the Coventry Evening Telegraph as a local reporter. And I learnt a lot. The standards were very high in those days on local journalism, and my colleagues were outstanding and taught me a lot. But I felt restless. And I organised my own freelance trip to southern Sudan and found a story and sold it to the national papers and just loved being abroad as a reporter. And in fact, because one of my stories was seen in the Sunday Times, a BBC producer rang up and said, can we talk to you about your experience? I'd managed to slip with the help of a UN friend into a part of Uganda that people had not visited for a few years. So I had a bit of a scoop. And I was ushered into the BBC to talk on the BBC World Service in a radio studio. And I just fell in love with that. You know, A, it was easier than having to write your story. You just spoke about it. And the producer said that I had a knack for explaining stuff. And I thought, well, okay. So I'd already tried to get into the BBC a few years before and failed. So I tried again, got in that time. And it became very apparent quickly that in those days, this was the early 80s, if you really wanted to get on in the BBC as a news correspondent, above all, if you wanted to get abroad, you needed to prove yourself. And the classic way to do that in those days was to try to get to Northern Ireland, because that was so busy and violent and challenging. And I managed to get to Northern Ireland and was there for a couple of years with the most amazingly skilled professional teams of people. I mean, cameramen who really knew their way around a riot. Other reporters who were superb with sharing their knowledge about what to do and what to do. Where to park, things like, you know, if you're going to cover a riot, where do you park your car so that the car doesn't get burnt, right? You know, you need to kind of really think this stuff through. And I like to think that I kind of imbibe this knowledge. And but it was all really part of an objective to catch the eye of editors, I suppose. It feels very selfish saying this now, but I was ambitious and try to get abroad. And that then got me a national news job in London and with the potential to go abroad. And I'll never forget one of the editors coming over to say, are you free to go to Brussels this weekend? Just for a two-day assignment. And the travel agent in the newsroom issued me with an air ticket and just gave me this ticket, right? And I thought, this is cool. Someone gives you a ticket, right? And it was a story about the First World War. And I went over to Brussels with a great team and we did that story. But it kind of confirmed to me that, you know, there's a world of possibility, particularly with TV news in those days, and just great things to report on. And in those days, the audiences were enormous for BBC News and the other channels. And so there was a lot of satisfaction, actually, in knowing that you were providing a window on the world for people sitting at home who maybe were never going to get to the kind of places that you go to and the places that I went on to go to. And someone the other day said, oh, how many countries have you been to now? And it's over 100. And that's because of the different jobs I had at the BBC. And I wish I could say I'd really planned it, you know, but nothing is always luck, isn't there? And opportunities come along and you try to make sense of them and maybe they work, maybe they don't.
But it's quite clear that you were very sort of hungry and ambitious. I mean, you said as much, you were ambitious. And I think, you know, but I'd love to talk to you about the kind of altruistic side of the work you do and how important you felt it was. But before we do, I feel like we shouldn't gloss over sneaking into Uganda as a young man. I mean, you just sort of threw that in there as a standalone sentence, but it might be worth embellishing that story somewhat.
Okay, so I was the hungry young reporter on a freelance trip, and I had an inn in southern Sudan, now South Sudan, a separate country, but in those days it was still part of Sudan, and a whole crowd, I mean, hundreds of thousands of refugees were living in southern Sudan who'd come from Uganda. The infamous dictator Idi Amin, when he was driven from office, the forces that took over Uganda actually took revenge on Idi Amin's people for all the atrocities that he'd committed and drove them out. And they were all sheltering in southern Sudan. And actually, they kind of weren't really being looked after very well. One of the problems was there weren't quite enough of them to be a huge global crisis, which meant that no news organization would send their staff people to cover this situation. But there was a genuine situation there and real hardship and challenges and not enough aid workers. And kind of I was there as a freelance trying to find a way into that story, and I had great contacts who helped me tell the story. And while I was there, one of my UN contacts introduced me to another UN contact, and we got chatting and hit it off. And this guy said, actually, he was going the next day over the border from southern Sudan into Uganda to sort of check it out on an official UN reconnaissance, to see if he could recommend whether the refugees now sheltering in southern Sudan should be able to return. And he just kind of looked at me and said, do you want to come with me? And I didn't have any of the right papers. I didn't whatever. And I said, look, I'm up for it if you are. And he said, show me what shirts you've got. So I reached into my rucksack and pulled out some stinking old shirts. And one was blue and not that different to the blue of the UN. And he said, stick that shirt on and be ready at 4 a.m. tomorrow. And he turned up in his Land Rover. I hopped in with him, amazing Irish guy. And we set off and we got to the border, and he talked his way over the border. He had a brilliant approach with officials and soldiers and whatever, utterly charming. And I was kind of explained as his slightly dumb assistant, you know, and, oh, there's this guy, you don't worry about him. And then we spent the day in this ghost land. I mean, the towns were deserted. The few people who were left were utterly unsupported and cared for, and we saw people who were desperately malnourished and ill. We saw Idi Amin's famous camper van that he'd had to abandon and had been riddled with bullet holes. And then we got to one town where there were quite a lot of soldiers. And I, being a journalist, got chatting, and the UN guy was off doing his business, whatever, with local officials. And I got chatting to these soldiers. And actually, I put a foot wrong. I asked too many questions. And they suddenly kind of crowded round, and the guns came up. And they didn't believe my useless cover story about being an education expert coming on a UN mission. And there was commotion so loud that my companion and guide left his meeting in a building nearby and ran towards me and pushed his way through the crowd and stood beside me very firmly and gave a speech about, isn't it wonderful that young people from all over the world are helping Uganda rebuild? And isn't it kind of amazing that someone like this young guy, useless though he is come all the way from Britain to sort of see what he can do to help? And he spoke so charmingly and warmly and realistically that the guns came down and the crowd sort of receded. And then he just whacked me with his elbow in the ribs and says, get in the car. And I jumped into the Land Rover, and he said his goodbyes. And he said, I'm right getting you out now. We can't stay in Uganda any longer. And the nearest border was not Sudan, where I'd come from that morning, but actually what was then called Zaire, now Democratic Republic of Congo, because the three countries meet. And he said, I'm just getting you out of here. And we drove to the Congolese border, and we just over the border, got out, okay, and got over the border. And there was a Médecins Sans Frontières base that he knew about, and he said, can we have a night here? And he explained who I was and whatever. And then I was then stuck there. He then pushed off and did his thing. And I was stuck there because there was only one truck a week that went from this little town in Congo back to where I'd started in Sudan. And I just missed the truck. So I had a week with MSF and tried to help them and saw for the first time what it's like to be on the front line of providing medical care, and full of admiration ever since for those guys. But eventually the truck turned up. I got on it. It was carrying bundles of dried fish in 35 degrees of heat. And it took all day to it's another long story. It took all day to get back to Sudan. And I got over the border and I got back to the people who'd been looking after me before. And they were desperately worried because you couldn't communicate in those days. And I feel that that week kind of just changed me, my life, by sense of adventure. And what I haven't confessed until now is I was, as a kid, I was brought up on The Adventures of Tintin, the young reporter, getting into scrapes and kind of exposing bad stuff. And that's what I wanted to do. And I felt for a little bit like maybe I had a little bit of Tintin going on there. And so that was for me a kind of absolutely mind-blowingly eye-opening experience.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. And I think for many people, they would kind of say, right, okay, didn't quite mean for that to happen. Home time, you know, let's not do that again. It doesn't seem like that's what happened to you, really.
No, because, you know, there's the folly of youth, isn't there? Because you survive one scrape, you think it's not going to happen. But then, you know, you go on to have experiences that are profoundly shaking. I mean, my first assignment in Northern Ireland, there was sort of predicted to be some trouble in what's officially called Londonderry, but everybody calls Derry. There was some rioting, and I got there with a very experienced team. And at one end of the street, you had soldiers and police, and the other end, you had young guys. And there was a bit of an exchange of sort of missile fire. There was a hijacked truck burning in the middle of the kind of battle zone. And there was a little area to one side where kind of reporters could stand, you know, and observe and apparently be safe, except when the truck blew up. And that was the first time I felt a shockwave. The truck exploded. Nothing hit us, but I felt the wave go through my belly. And it was profoundly destabilizing and unnerving. And the cameraman had filmed some scenes of the rioting, and there wasn't a lot going on, and the newsroom weren't that interested anyway. And so we walked back to our car, and by arrangement made by the cameraman, who knew what he was doing, and I didn't, I was a green new boy, but the cameraman had insisted that one of the crew stayed in the driver's seat and don't get out of the car, be ready to drive off. And as we got close to the car, carrying the gear, I was carrying the tripod, another guy was carrying whatever, the fourth member of the team got out of the driver's seat to help us open the boot and get the gear in the car. And at that moment, two young blokes in balaclavas barged past us, jumped into the two front seats, and sped off in our car. And we were left looking like utter idiots with tens of thousands of pounds worth of camera equipment in a riot. And it was dark, and we still had the after effects of the truck exploding, and I was thoroughly unnerved. And then a guy appeared from a little alleyway and said, I know where your car is, I can get it back for you, but one of you has to come with me. And as the reporter in a news team, you're kind of meant to be the leader. I mean, you know, it's you're the front person. So I knew that much, despite being an idiot in so many other ways. And I said, well, I'd better do it. And the cameraman, who was, I was in my late 20s or something, and the mid-20s, and the cameraman who was in his early 50s, who had seen everything, wars and whatever, he just said, kind of effectively, look, laddie, there's no way you're doing that. I'm doing it. And we argued, and he won, and I lost, and I felt utterly cowardly and like I just failed, and watched this chap, Dave, go down the alleyway with this guy who'd offered to help get the car back. And it was the longest 5 minutes of my life. And then eventually he did actually turn up in the car, and the petrol had been siphoned out to use in petrol bombs. And we all piled into the car and raced to our hotel and got there just before the bar shut and lined up Bushmills whiskies. And I'm not a drinker, really. I don't drink a lot. And I think I had 5 or 6 whiskies, and it made no difference. The adrenaline and sort of fear was just so overwhelming. And so that was another lesson that you, just when you think, oh, I've survived slipping into Uganda, right? That's just part of the story. There's an awful lot more to learn.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it would have been really easy for you to carry on down that path. And maybe in some ways you did. But, you know, these are humanitarian stories, conflict stories. When did the transition begin towards kind of environment and science? And do you see those things as linked, I guess?
Well, they are linked. But I had a profoundly upsetting and difficult experience that led to the shift in career. I'd always thought of myself as highly capable, experienced reporter, go anywhere. I had a couple of trips to Bosnia during the war and various other scraps on the fringes of the Soviet Union while it was breaking up. So I kind of had been in situations where people were firing at us and artillery going off and being in Sarajevo under siege and all of that. But I realized I was accumulating memories. And I was thinking back a lot to sometimes quite minor incidents that were upsetting. And there came a time just over 20 years ago, 21 years ago, when we were in Tajikistan in Central Asia covering a famine. I mean, there was a part of the former Soviet Union where everything had collapsed and people were dying of hunger. And we were there doing this story when 9/11 happened and the Twin Towers collapsed. And suddenly we realized, and the newsroom suddenly realized back in London, we're next door to Afghanistan, where Osama bin Laden was based, the mastermind of this massive attack. And could we get into Afghanistan? And plans were made and there were discussions and there was the possibility of going on a really, really ropey old helicopter over Taliban positions to get to where the then anti-Taliban crowd were based, the Northern Alliance, and they would be happy to have us and so forth. And I was with a really brilliant cameraman and a superb producer, both of whom were up for this trip. But as it became sort of more and more organized and the day when we might have done it got closer, I realized I didn't have the nerve. I didn't want to go in the helicopter. I didn't want to fly over Taliban territory with shoulder-launched missiles. I didn't want to go to Afghanistan. I didn't have the bottle. And there was I can talk about it now, but for a long time I found it was very difficult to. I had a phone call with my foreign editor, where, of course, in London, they were really keen for this trip to happen. Global Scoop was about to take place. And I rang and I said, look, I can't do it. And there was a long pause on the phone when the editor realized and I realized that I was kind of announcing a massive, well, it felt massive at the time, a change of direction, of career, of whatever. And actually everybody was supportive. I mean, I'm sure they were crushingly disappointed in London, but they wouldn't tell me. And the cameraman and producer I was with could not have been better about it. They followed the rule set up by the legendary Martin Bell, the war correspondent, where if you're in a team and one of the team feels uneasy as you're driving down some track or just gets a bad feeling, they say so, and B, with no recrimination or discussion, you just turn around and go back. And you ring London and say, there's no story. And if London say, well, Sky have got this amazing stuff, where are you? You just say, we made a decision as a team not to pursue this. And so we left Tajikistan, and, was it easy for me? No. But I'm telling you all this because when I got back to London, and then there was a whole lot of sort of further discussion, a really wonderful editor said he'd been giving some thought about what I maybe would do next. If I didn't want to go any more to any kind of conflict, he said, how about environment and science? He said, we like the way you explain stuff. We want you to keep traveling. We get it. You don't want to be shot at anymore. How about environment and science? And do you know what? Initially, it felt too tame. And my wife said, when I told her about it, she said, well, don't be an ass. That sounds brilliant. And one of the editors said, look, when I asked, well, what is this job? He said, look, it's anything, any picture that's on the front cover of National Geographic. The moons of Jupiter, icebergs, coral, rainforest, canyons. That's what we want. Just go off and do it. And I thought, well, okay, that sounds okay. And so this great pivot in my career happened because I was a silver lining to a horrifically difficult personal moment. And yeah, that was. So I started in beginning of 2003 in this new role, not really having given it much thought other than the cover of National Geographic, which has been a wonderful kind of guide for me because it's such an outstanding publication.
I get the idea, of what you're going to say, but I have to ask, looking back, do you regret not getting in the helicopter?
Do you know, a bit of me, of course, does. A bit of me wonders, would I have got a great story? Would I have made a lot of noise in the newspapers and won an award? Probably all of those things. Would I've had great recognition from my peers? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, probably. Looking back, I know I made the right decision. I know I made the right decision for me on the basis of just not being the kind of person who can keep going into those really, really scary situations. Knowing I didn't want any more memories that were disturbing potentially and difficult to deal with, and of course looking back now, blimey, there was no way now and back then I could have known what the following 20 years would lead to, which is a profoundly fulfilling role on the greatest challenge of our time. And so, yes, I mean, look, I'm being honest with you, Matt, there's a 5-10% thing running there, like, what would that have been like? But the overwhelming conclusion is, that was a good move.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, and it's, I think what really fascinates me is it's often easy to reflect on a decision that we made which felt awful at the time that resulted in something amazing, like the career you've gone on to have. But at the time, what did it do to you psychologically after you made that decision and returned home?
Oh, it reinforced a sense of humility. It reinforced a kind of staggering admiration for all of my friends and colleagues who continued to go and do that kind of thing. I mean, in Ukraine, for example, I'm in Syria, speechless with admiration because I know kind of what it's like for them and the logistics and the conditions and the challenges. And so that's a kind of positive, actually, to see that and to really value what they do in terms of sharing with the rest of the world the reality of some of these horrific situations, you know, staggering abuses by Russian forces in Ukraine, for example. So yeah, it's that's opened up a whole pathway of thinking. I mean, I always had fans, you know, and I was an admirer of others, and could kind of see, yeah, okay, they're doing an outstanding job, and I really really worship them for it, but it's not for me. So you do have to recalibrate. It makes you think, which I'm very bad at. I mean, I've never wanted to think about the next step or my own role in anything. But I think with age and big life experiences, you're forced to learn about yourself and what your limits are, and they're hard to deal with. You know, that I would, like, never be a sort of hero war reporter. And it forces you then to think about, well, what am I perhaps kind of good at? And it's this thing that people always say, oh yeah, you're good at explaining stuff. We want more of it. The world's complicated and changing in profound ways, and we need someone to tell us about it. And so that led to that.
Yeah. No, and I mean, that's where I want to go with this, but I often, you know, the more I talk to people and do my own job, the more I realize that actually sometimes the question is, why do they feel the need to? Rather than why didn't you want to? You know, why do people feel the need to climb the hardest mountains? Why run off to the most dangerous conflict zone? Like, those are, you know, I wouldn't say that those people are perhaps the happiest in the world, at a guess. So, you know, maybe you made an excellent decision.
I think in many walks of life, we're competitive, aren't we? And we have drive. The drive can be destructive. It can be self-destructive. Ambition can be a good thing or a bad thing if it's excessive. I think to see a positive, there's sort of energy as a force for good. That, you know, are you the sort of person that gets out of bed in the morning wanting to do things and make a difference if you possibly can and change something or enlighten someone and or inform someone about a situation? And I think for most of my friends who keep going to conflicts, it's that there's bad, shitty, evil stuff happening in the world, and a very small band of people are prepared to go to those places and share with the vast majority what they're all about. And I think that's an important role. And for me, I've just realized as I've gone through the years that I love it when I report on something or talk to somebody or a group or a school that you can see when people get a point. They were confused about something or didn't really want to think about it much and then get it. And for me, there's immense satisfaction in that. You know, I did do a bit of teaching when I was 18 years old in India. I'd had a gap year between school and university and spent most of it in India and taught in a school for the kids who were then described as untouchable. They were the outcasts from society and they had nothing and there was no glass on the windows, even in winter, and it was cold. And as each teacher was given two pieces of chalk, I realized, well, this is the reality of education in a really poor society. But I realized, actually, I realized I was enjoying engaging with kids and providing what I hoped were eye-opening moments. And so a little bit of me has always wanted to be a teacher, and not a preacher, because I hate being preached at. You mustn't do this, you must do that. But a teacher, I think, is such an important role in life, and a bit of me wanted to do it.
No, but in many ways, I mean, it's quite clear, you know, you're leading me into this and it's very kind of you, but in many ways, that's what you are now, right?
I think I've ended up as that. But, you know, the journey to get there, these things always seem obvious in retrospect, don't they? But, I mean, at the time, I'd had this whole life-changing experience and started to report on environment and science. As I confess quite openly now, but didn't really at the time, I was quite cynical about environmental stories. I mean, I'd grown up as a kid with a Save the Whale badge and you know, I was sympathetic to the idea of saving the rainforest and so forth. But, you know, I actually also thought environmental campaigners were exaggerating to raise money for their organizations. And just a bit of me, classic journalist, thought things can't be that bad about pollution and about forests and what climate and whatever. And so I had this discussion with editors and said, look, why don't I, as a starting point in this new job, go and visit the key research teams out in the field on the different front lines and find out what they're discovering about what's really going on and tune out from environmental campaigners, just like, what are the scientists discovering about the Arctic and about Greenland, about Siberia and the Amazon, and what's really going on? And I look back now, and it was amazingly supportive editors, but I had this great run of assignments all over the world with the objective of actually, for me, of like, just discovering what was going on, what's the best evidence for what's happening, but also to obviously to share that with the biggest possible audience. And, you know, we went live on the 10 o'clock news from Antarctica and up the Amazon and all this kind of stuff. And the objective was to share what I was finding out with the largest number of people and to be very, very clear about what science can tell us and what it doesn't know. And to kind of make that distinction very, very clear, because I thought that was a way of dealing with what was then rampant climate denialism. And I thought a more effective engagement with that or how to deal with it was not to be sort of binary, but to say, yeah, look, I'm going to stand by this evidence because it's really strong. But that, yeah, we don't really know about that. The top profs don't know about that. Now, let's be open about it. And so that led me to this series of assignments. And in fact, one BBC presenter said, he called across the newsroom, he said, Shukman, you've got yourself the most ridiculous job. You go to amazing parts of the world and tell us they're buggered. And, you know, the whole newsroom sort of fell silent. And but he was right in a way. But what I was experiencing on a personal basis was like a series of vigorous slaps around the face. Look, yes, the trees of the Amazon really are being hacked down on a horrific scale. Bang. The Greenland ice, yes, it really is melting in a way that worries us and will raise sea levels. Sort of slap. You know, the permafrost of Siberia really is thawing and releasing methane on a scale that's terrifying. Another bash across the head. And so it kind of, I mean, being cynical, I kind of needed that experience. But the learning experience was, we are trashing the planet at an unprecedented rate and ruining the few natural allies that we have in the fight against climate change. But, you know, one of the great allies is the Amazon rainforest, and we're just chopping it down. And to be able to share with people the experience of stepping from noisy, rich, biodiverse, humid rainforest with billions of little squawkings and screechings and screams and the cries of birds to sterile, empty, baking hot, scorching monoculture, fields of soya, or overheated cattle scrabbling around for a bit of grass in Brazil was, I thought, a kind of valuable role and profoundly moving for me. And wherever I've seen that, I've tried to share it. And I think Greenland for me was one of the most stunning, because I had a trip to Greenland in 2004 with a team of scientists to the edge of the ice sheet. But back then, the scientists were really worried about the pace of melting. Actually, to me, it seemed like there was plenty of ice, great 200-meter tall cliffs and ice everywhere. And then 15 years later, I went back to exactly the same spot. And it's bare rock. The glacier's retreated, its elevation has halved. There's been this massive shedding of ice. The ice looks battered and sad. And so when I get accosted, it happens less now, but I used to always get like, you're a shill for the wind industry, or you're part of Greenpeace, you're whatever. You know, my uncle read on Facebook that whatever, global warming's not true. You know, I can say, look, I've seen it, guys. I've been there repeatedly. And 15 trips to the Arctic, and said, don't argue with me about what's going on in the Arctic. And so I felt it gave me a strength and my own personal evidence, as well as the scientific evidence, obviously, in order to really make the case and try to persuade people.
So have you remained cynical, or are you, you know, in the face of everything you've seen, have you become an optimist, a realist?
I'm personally, I think, an optimist by nature. I think you, if you've got sort of a drive to do things, that's going to make you optimistic, I think. But I'm also realistic about the scale of the challenge. And if I'm cynical, it's about sincerity in climate change. So what's happened, so as well as going to the Arctic and doing all these assignments in different parts of the world, I started going to these dreadful COPs, COP26 being the most recent, COP27 is coming up next month, right? My first COP was COP11 in Montreal in 2005. And what really struck me there was it was environmentalists and environment ministers and environment organizations, and everything was environment, right? And it seemed to me, what we're talking about is changing the global economy. And where are the industry ministers and the finance people, and where are the banks and heavy, the big industrialists and the big businesses? They weren't there. And I mean, perhaps some of them were operating in the background, trying to derail, delay, obstruct, and generally hamper the progress of this whole thing. But they weren't overtly part of the story. And you fast forward to COP26, and suddenly every company on the planet, well, at least many of them, are sort of, oh, well, you know, you go on their websites and there's a picture of a little girl holding a planet Earth and tree planting schemes and all the rest of it, all want to look green. And so where I'm cynical is about the degree of honesty and authenticity about that engagement. I happen to think we're only going to turn this round and keep the world from becoming uninhabitable if particularly the big businesses are involved, because they're the outfits that make the products that that get used, the cars and planes and ships and buildings and steel and cement or whatever. And there are signs of really positive change in all of those sectors, interestingly. I mean, not fast enough, but there are positive signs there. But along with this unprecedented degree of corporate engagement, where everybody, as I say, even the most carnivorous, fossil fuel hungry companies want to look climate friendly, planet positive, there's a tsunami of greenwash. And we're wading waist deep through green paint that's being sprayed over power stations and sort of hosed over factories and you know, to dress up business as usual, to look as eco as possible. And I think a role that I'm obsessed with is whenever I'm talking to anyone from a large corporation, is to try to make clear what my understanding of the science is. And the science tells us very clearly we've got to halve emissions globally by 2030. And emissions are going up, not down. So what are we all going to do about that? And if they don't come down by half, we've had a taste this summer of what that means. The 40 degrees in the UK, 70-day heat wave in China, a drought so profound in Europe that the Rhine is impassable to larger ships, fires, Pakistan, a third of it underwater. I mean, these are the things that happen on a 1 degree hotter world, and we're heading for 2 or 3. So I kind of like to make that clear and say greenwashing is not a cosmetic problem. It's not a kind of, well, we've got some clever marketing or whatever. Greenwashing means we won't keep the world safe. If everybody's greenwashing, we're not going to keep the world safe. And so, as I say, it's an obsession. Kind of, my language since leaving the BBC has become blunter, but I think we're short of time. And I kind of feel that if I'm in with bosses, they need to hear what this is really all about. And I'm impatient, polite, but impatient. And I think if that's a role that's useful, that shifts the dial, helps the penny drop, fantastic.
And so how do you, I mean, you've said, you know, you're an optimist and that's just your nature, but how do you keep hold of hope when you've seen what you've seen for 20 years, you've seen that it's not going well, emissions are going up, you're speaking to big business, etc. How do you get out of bed every day?
So, because I've seen some wonderful progress in a really short space of time. So 20 years ago, I went to the Northumberland coast and filmed Britain's, this is one example, filmed Britain's first offshore wind farm, a rather forlorn collection of turbines just off the beach at Blyth. And I consulted all the experts in the energy world who almost universally said, A, it'll never work, because don't they know there are storms in the North Sea and these things will fall over? And B, it's just so expensive. It's the most ludicrous idea. It's too difficult. And 10 years later, 2013, I was climbing a 100-meter tall tower in the Irish Sea, which was then the construction of the world's largest offshore wind farm, with what was then the world's largest wind turbines, 5 megawatts. And the experts who had originally been so negative said, well, okay, look, it's true, these things work, and it is viable, and they don't fall over, and the power can be brought ashore, but it's still way too expensive. So we then fast forward to now, where offshore wind is 9 times cheaper than gas. And there's 10 gigawatts of offshore capacity around the UK. It's a huge success story. And there are wonderful new green jobs that are springing up. I've interviewed bright young people, energetic, planet committed, working on offshore wind farms, doing maintenance and design and engineering. And there's often in quite desolate towns on the east coast of England, where everything else has collapsed, And suddenly there are these new industries. Spend an hour or two with someone in their early 20s, as I did last year, training to go out to the North Sea to look after these massive new installations. God, that's energizing and inspiring. And, you know, what that tells me is that with the right government support, the right incentives for industry, motivated people and clever engineers, in a really short space of time, you can just change things. In that's only one example. Another one, I've been doing a bit of work to support the city of Hull become net zero. And we had a launch event earlier this year, and Alex Sharma, the president of COP26, came and presided over it. And it was an amazing event, bringing together companies big and small, and the university and the city council and the NHS Trust. And one of the most amazing things I thought was the NHS Trust in Hull has built its own solar park. It's got a little field with solar panels for its own power. And at the same time, the port in Hull has huge flat roof buildings, which they've covered in solar panels. And I was talking to the boss and I said, that's a big investment, millions of quid. How long till you get your money back? Because, you know, 15 years ago, it used to be at least a decade to get your money back on solar. And I thought he might say 6, 7, 8 years. He said, I'll get my money back in 2 years because the electricity price is so high, it makes business sense. And you think, blimey, if a really hard-nosed company running a port wants to cover its buildings with solar panels and it makes business sense, that's also exhilarating because suddenly it makes sense. And I think once you start to see the pivot in these sorts of industries, it does give me hope. Probably not that we'll get there in time, but can we get a long way towards where we need to be quite quickly? Sure.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, but I have lots of conversations about this topic with friends, colleagues, family, etc. And I just kind of, one thing that always confuses me is I just don't think we have a choice. You kind of, you know, we've got to try as hard as we can. We'll probably not succeed in the way that we'd like to. So what do we do instead? You know, we're going to keep having to adapt, having to change. And obviously it's essential that people like you are going around saying, don't just pretend, you know, you need to do it properly, please. Stop profiting on pretending to save the world. But that's my point. What choice do we have other than to try?
If you read the science, we don't have a choice. I mean, we obviously could ignore it all and sort of hope it all somehow goes away, or know it's going to get worse and just spend a huge amount of money on trying to adapt. But that's not going to be possible everywhere for everybody. Surely better to do what we are, what the scientists have laid out as a pathway that will not avoid all the bad things, but will minimize them. And I feel physically sick reading the IPCC reports about the difference between a rise of 1.5 and 2. You know, what it means for coral, what it means for sea level rise, what it means for Greenland, what it means for so many people in countries that are already pretty hot about whether they'll be able to work out of doors on building sites and on farms. And the implications are absolutely staggering. And it's almost unreadable to see what a 3-degree world would look like, let alone beyond. And so I think there's a moral compulsion. And I think there's, and I increasingly find that this is quite an effective argument. There's a pragmatic compulsion. I mean, you can argue that the richest nations need to do way, way more than they are right now to help poorer ones prepare or deal with the existing climate threat. And you can make a humanitarian case. Look, Pangla, Pakistan, for example, right? I mean, that's a screaming humanitarian case. You can also make a more hard-nosed case based on self-interest. And I wonder whether this will cut through more effectively. So, for example, there was a terrible storm and flooding in Durban in South Africa. The port of Durban was badly damaged and disrupted and closed for a while. And you might think, if you're sitting in London or wherever, well, who cares? Durban's a long way off. Well, most of the world's cobalt, which we keep hearing more about, comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo out through Durban. And it goes to China for processing. And that flow of a really essential resource was disrupted because of a storm that damaged Durban. And so the prices of components that contain cobalt, which we all use, went up, right? Now, that's one example of, yeah, there you go, supply chain, phones and everything. Anything with a battery is likely to have a bit of cobalt in it. And I'm wondering whether that argument cuts through. If people have got compassion fatigue, or they're bored of people saying that climate change is leading to doom and gloom, might they be moved by this different argument that trade, industry, commerce, jobs in your own country might be affected if you don't help everybody deal with tougher conditions that come with a more hostile climate?
Yeah, it's a compelling argument. I mean, you'd hope so, wouldn't you? I think it's impossible to answer the question. And I think it's also deeply personal. I mean, the one, again, I've had this conversation, this specific conversation with a few people who I'm close to, and my argument is always lots of people are bored. You know, one of the problems with being middle class in Britain, as wonderful as it is, and we don't realise how wonderful, is people get bored really easily. And that's, you know, a lot of adventure can mitigate that boredom. But equally, you know, Sebastian Junger writes about interviewing survivors of the Blitz in the war, and they all said they missed it. They missed being bombed. And every, you know, his conclusion is it was purpose. Of course it was purpose, community and purpose. And I just think for all of these kind of disenfranchised people out there who are bored, nothing to do, you know, don't feel like they're in fulfilling jobs. Well, there's this big problem that is going to affect all of us and everyone on planet Earth without question, assuming you're sort of under the age of 60, you know, if you're under the age of 40, probably significantly. Get around that, you know. You don't need to go anywhere with an assault rifle, but there's a lot you can do.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think one of the big shifts, societal shifts I've detected in the time of my engagement with this, 20 years, is that when I started, it was all about the future. The models were all about, really, about the back half of this century. That's when the trouble was going to kick in. You know, 2 degrees was described as a safety limit. We've got to keep the temperature rise to 2 degrees because beyond that gets dangerous, right? That's how this was described. And certainly part of the reason for my travels to Bangladesh and the Kalahari Desert, wherever I went, was because I'd been led to believe by scientists and everybody that actually Britain as a temperate island wouldn't see a lot of change. Summers might be a bit hotter, there might be a bit more flooding, but it wasn't really a problem for us. You know, if you wanted to see the problem, you had to go a long way away. And that mindset of distance and things being far off in time had a profound effect on the coverage, my own approach to it. And then suddenly, in the last, 7, 8 years, the Paris Agreement 2015 started to talk about 1.5 as an ideal kind of limit, and people started dropping the word safe in conjunction with 2 degrees, and freaky stuff started to happen in temperate parts of the world, including the UK. But it's, I think, always been the case where, and it's maybe human nature, and I'm not an expert in our psychology, but I'm starting to read a lot more about it. I think as I needed my face slapped with what we're doing to the planet, I think we don't really engage or change until we are slapped in the face. And I think 40 degree temperatures in the UK this past summer is one part of that. And I've noticed a shift in conversations and the way people frame all this, that it starts to make a different kind of sense that this isn't that a planet that's 1.1 degree hotter means something. And it doesn't just mean Bangladesh gets flooded more often. It means you get hotter more often. And that conservatory you stuck on the back of your house without blinds or shutters becomes uninhabitable in hot weather. And you know, these are discoveries that people are making. I've taken part in discussions where people were really worried about how do they keep their kids cool at night so they can sleep and go to school the next day. Most British houses aren't designed for these temperatures. So I think these are kind of profound shifts that are cutting through. And I think the silver lining would be that they change the nature of the debate.
It has to be. Yeah, I think it has to be the case. Well, no, before I veer too far off track and just start, you know, discussing and debating the finer points of it all, I think the answer's obvious, but what is it you intend to do with the rest of your career and the rest of your life?
So a mix of things. I said to someone the other day, I kind of want to be useful. I just like the idea of being useful. I've been incredibly privileged to have had the experiences that I've had and to be given the opportunities to gather insights and stories. And if they land with people, as I think they do, I need to be on the front foot and sharing them with really anybody who asks, or I bash on doors to try to be. I don't think I'd be a good protester, gluing myself. That's not me. I don't think I'd be any use kind of joining a political party and trying to affect change that way. I don't really want to join any big organizations, having been in one for so long. So I think as a sort of gun for hire, freelance advocate, educator, is what I want to do. And so that's led me, for example, to be, I'm going to go to COP27 for part of it and help with discussions around that. I'm talking to various people about potential trips to the Arctic. That's with Martin Hartley, a buddy of yours. And I think you're involved in that as well. And you know, fingers crossed. And I think because for me, you know, the Arctic, we all know it's the fastest changing region on Earth. And I think we all need to be shouting about it a lot. And I want to keep across that. So, yeah, look, for me, it's a mix of broadcasting, if it comes along, of talks, of moderating sessions, of guiding, of working behind the scenes, if I think that's potentially influential. But all the time thinking of a little note that was written to me by a wonderful cousin of my wife's. And as I left the BBC, we had a long chat, and she's a wonderful, she's got one of these brains that just cuts straight to what you're thinking about. And she wrote this little note and said, keep this. She said, all the years have been given to you to help save our little planet. And I think it just, I wanted to weep and hug her. Well, I did weep and hug her. But I keep that on my desk. And I keep the thought with me that if there's anything I can do, whatever it is, to help shift the dial, I'm up for it. And I think of all the people who've who've helped me on that sort of journey of discovery. You know, in Bangladesh, we filmed a storm had blasted holes in the mud embankment, keeping seawater out of a village and the fields. And every high tide, salty water was just pouring in and poisoning the fields and flooding the homes. And gangs of blokes in a human chain were trying to use handfuls of mud. That's all they had to fix the holes. And, you know, we spent time with them. And they couldn't have been more polite and sort of engaged. And I was with my cameraman. We were waist deep in the mud and actually realized we were sinking. And these guys wanted to help us out and back onto dry land. But they didn't want to do it with their muddy hands. They wanted to offer their upper arms that weren't muddy. And I just thought, God, you know, there's such power in dignity and courtesy and civilized engagement. They were thrilled that the BBC had come to report on their plight, and they wanted to make our time there as useful and as pleasant as possible. And this sense of being lifted out of the mud by two guys who were themselves utterly, utterly covered in mud, apart from their upper arms, and they hoiked me up. I just thought, you know, I owe it to them. I owe it to so many people to try to keep talking about these issues and trying to affect change. And they often come to mind. And I think those are the great motivators. It's individuals whose eyes you catch in a difficult situation. You think, I want to help you.
Hey, hey. Well, look, you know, we're slightly over time and I feel like I could talk to you for hours, but I always end the podcast with two questions, always the same two. What scares you?
What scares me is what my kids face as they get older. I won't be around for the worst of climate change. I've seen the models. I don't like them. And as the decades roll by, things get tough. And I really, really worry about that. I worry about the implications of huge numbers of people having to leave parts of the world that become uninhabitable and the reception they're going to get from countries, including our own, that are not always very receptive. That scares me. So it's a fear for others about the direction we're going in.
And what brings you hope?
Innovative, energetic, motivated people who get together and share stories and ideas. And I've seen that and been part of it like never before. I love the way that what began for me as a very compartmentalized discussion, you had the climate scientist in one corner, you had government sort of in another, you had businesses over here, you had the NGOs there. Now we're seeing a lot of people from different walks of life coming together very productively. And I've witnessed this, and it's very, very exciting to see a social scientist talking to a physical scientist, talking to the head of a big business, talking to officials from a treasury, talking to brilliant analysts from an NGO, working together. It doesn't happen enough, but the fact that it's happening and people are sharing and communicating in a dialogue where everybody has the same goal, but they bring different types of expertise together in a way that I haven't seen before. And it's the mechanism that I think gives us the best chance of getting out of trouble. Motivated, energetic, clever, cooperative human nature. And that's what I love to see. And that's what I need to see to avoid getting depressed.
Amazing. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very, very much.
Well, look, thank you for your questions, and it's been a huge pleasure, and I admire what you do. So good luck with it all.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit theadventurepodcast.co.uk. The podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft and is produced and edited by Orla O'Murray. If you want to get in touch, then you can do so at info@theadventurepodcast.co.uk, or you can get in touch on Instagram. And finally, please do leave us a review on iTunes. They make the world of difference to us accessing new audiences.
How's it? My name is Les Eddy. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come on, let me show you something. Oh, careful. Can you see it? Oh, trust me. It can see you. There, between the trees. It's not every day you get to see a rhino on a walk. I guess not everyone is taken to the right places, but you will be if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com and don't just travel. Explore.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.